class, my first or second year here. And I always just included the black history right in with my regular U.S. history students, because after all, they are an ethnic group. So I had this graduate class, and most of these people, of course, were teachers. And I was talking away, and in the heat of it, I was talking something about the black American. And these kids in class said, not kids, of course, they were in their 30s probably, but they said, now, whoa, we don't know what you're talking about. I said, don't you people know black history? No. I said, why don't you? Boy, they put it right back to me, because in college we were not taught black history. I said, we'll take care of that. And that's when I started having my, my class. Then I had each summer, I'd have seminars, especially for teachers to catch them up. That's the way I'm bringing these big people in. But most of the black kids we had at that time were from around here. That is Pittsburgh, Erie, this is it. But we started getting some from Philadelphia, in that area. And our black kids here today, they're from another world. And I had one young fellow, I can't think of his name, doesn't matter now. Dandy nice kid from Philadelphia. Bright, straight A's, you know. So I always had a panel the first day of a black kid, just telling these teachers their experiences in this society being black. And this kid started in, he started using vulgar words, cuss words, you know. He just went, Adam. And my mouth dropped open because I never heard a kid talk like that, see. So finally, a couple of days, I called him aside and I said, look, I said, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to shock the fact. I said, what you're really doing is these people aren't paying attention a bit to what you're saying. They're only interested in the way you're saying it, all that dirty street talk. See?
Yeah.
But that's what you had. That was the difference between the two kids. So it's just like, of course, to me, the black kids from the city aren't similar to any other kids in the city. They're city kids. I think
they're
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me backtrack a little bit.
Well, you just fire the questions, and I'll try to answer
the backtrack a little bit. And at the beginning of every tape, I want to document what today is. So today is February the 10th, 1995. It's a little bit after 10 o'clock in the morning, and we're at the Baron Finesse Library. Present are Russell Vance, Randy Berlin, and myself, Dave Obringer. Today we're speaking with Russ Vance, who is also the author of A Portrait of Edinburgh. We wouldn't want to have anybody confused with a different Russell Vance.
Well, there's three of us, four of us. Did you know what I was talking about, how they messed up my book?
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at the front and then... Now, as a history student, where is the official title of a book?
In the inside cover.
Inside cover, the title page. Look at your dates here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now. The official title page, look at your dates there.
Sure different, aren't they?
You see that?
Oh, yeah. That's a former librarian. In addition to studying history, I studied. Yes, well, we've cataloged that correctly, so you don't need to.
That's all right. But that was another of those things, you know, when that book came out. God, I can't think. Yeah. If you get a simple thing like that.
Let me ask you about you personally and your background, and eventually not too personal, what eventually brought, how you came to Edinburgh.
Well, you know where I graduated from and all that.
Well, Bloomington, Indiana University, Bloomington.
Yeah, I got my degree at Indiana Central, Master's, Butler, PhD at IU. I always had to say Bloomington.
Oh, yeah.
Because when we first came here, and you know, Indiana University rarely won a football game. We used to be, we'd never asked if we win or lose, but how much did they beat us? But when we came here, IU went to the Rose Bowl. And so a group of them said, well, let's get together out to Culberson, which they still have this country club out there, watch the game, and we'll invite all IU graduates. Well, we invited a bunch of faculty, and they kept calling, why did you invite us? Graduated from Indiana. I was Indiana PA. So after I got my my degree, my PhD, I taught at Allegheny for 10 years. And
because I told you last time, they found out that it was so Ivy League that you couldn't go up to the next rank until the guy above you died or retired. And so we decided, a bunch of us decided to leave Allegheny. We didn't want to, we loved the school. And my wife was already teaching here. So I had a couple offers to other places, North Atlantic and California, a couple of my own alma mater and everything. But I decided that I could come here. Different.
Different, what's
the Allegheny in Edinburgh.
Oh.
Because you see, in Allegheny, heaven's sakes, you can imagine what your SAT scores were. Like a student,
yes.
I think the lowest was around 1250, 1340, something like that, you know. So I'd always, for 10 years, I'd been teaching kids, really didn't have to work very hard. I thought, well, this, being a state school, you'll get variety. And I did.
Yeah.
You got students here that should never have graduated from the sixth grade. Then you have other students that can't quite beat a cap at Harvard. It's a much more difficult.
More difficult for
teaching here. Oh, yes. Because, well, when you have those youngsters in class, it's so far apart as far as their building's concerned.
Yeah.
See, where do you hit? But that's the way I got here.
Okay. And then you wrote The History.
The History.
There wasn't a dissertation done about Edinburgh. It's not nearly as comprehensive as what you have. And to date, there's been nothing else published on the history of Edinburgh. So, how did you get involved with doing this? What made you go into that?
Well, recall that that was your bicentennial.
Okay.
1976. So a couple years before that, and I forget what year it was, 73 or 74, President McNerney was talking about having a history group at college. And he came over to the history department, because he always had terrific respect for his faculty. So he came straight to the history department and said, yes, I'd be willing to do it. I had written the history of my alma mater, and he knew that because he was a Hoosier too. So, that's how I got doing it.
And so you started, what, about 73 and took 2 years?
Yes. Research, I would say the research took me about 2.5 years, maybe 3 years. And of course the writing. We didn't have computers for those things.
Right.
Word processing.
What was it like doing that research? Now we have
everything
trying catalog. To get an archive.
Well, I'll tell you, I went everywhere and anywhere. I think probably one of the most interesting ones was, besides the one I told you last time about the Goodell system.
Yeah.
Reading the Edinburgh Independent in the hayloft of their barn.
Yeah.
In the fall. I went over to the garage, and you know, during when the fire of Norma Hall, what they did was they just took all of the things and put them in the garage. As the kids would take the things out of the fire, they'd bring them over to the garage. So I would just poke it around, and I went over to the garage one day, and there on the floor was just a whole batch of paper. Now what had happened was that, I won't name the department, students in the department, but they were coming over there looking through the files for some specific object. See? Well, rather than putting their papers back, evidently this threw them on the floor of the garage. And now this is way after the fire. So somebody in administration had told the janitorial group to clean it up. Just take that paper and throw it away. And I said, don't touch it until I look at it. I said, I'm going through every piece of paper. Well, there wasn't much there, just the very first minutes of the very first trustees' minutes of Edinburgh. That's the
wow.
kind of thing. On the floor.
So
I got that, and of course I climbed up in cubby holes, and we had a basement where they had things in. And, I kept dirty.
Okay. It was all dispersed at all through camps. It was
all over.
Yeah.
It was all over here. Now, McNerney was trying to put a lot of it together. Of course, a lot of it, I'll have to admit, a lot of it was because of the fire, see,
yeah.
in Norma Hall. That when they took the stuff out to Norma Hall, they just put it any place they could. If it had been in Norma Hall, I'm sure it was all in place there.
Yeah.
Not that thing. Everything.
You came a couple years before the Norma Hall fire, 67.
Yes.
Did you use that building much, or did you?
Oh, yes, here, everything is in that building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
just think you don't, at that time, well, let's see, I think the science hall was built at that time. But there was practically nothing on this side of the road. Almost everything was done there. Get your mail there. Now, I didn't teach full classes in Normal Hall, but because we were always in Academy Hall. I'm telling you. It was actually a very interesting, beautiful building.
It's a real centerpiece for the campus.
Yep. Now you have the booklet of all the murals that the art students
I sure do. Yeah.
Those were terrific.
And the original, then there was one that they redid. The Alumni Association redid the mural.
They had a terrific pipe work on the third floor. It used to be the auditorium. Well, that was third floor. And above that, when basketball started, the basketball was there too. That's the reason they called it the cage sport. Do you know that? Well, they would actually build sort of a fence around an area.
Uh-huh.
And you were sort of in a cage, so the ball wouldn't go out. And we're talking about years and years ago.
Yes, I was coming from Indiana, you would know.
I think that tape of Sox Harrison, he might talk about it.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember what's on it. Oh, yes, I've talked a lot of the old players.
Sox is gone, though.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he was a good Irishman from across the country. He took me out there one day with Jim, his son. And he could tell me every person that lived in every home and tell me all about it. And I think his folks moved up there about 1902, 1904. Is that catching?
Yeah, go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, he was interesting. Yeah. Oh, he could tell some, I hope he does on that tape. I don't remember what's on there, see. That might just be Jim and his wife. I think Sox is on it. But he was telling about, what they used to call the old gym. I don't know what you call it now. It used to be the old student union, the little building.
Crawford?
Huh?
Crawford?
Oh, no. The old Fort Crawford.
That's the
theater.
The
theater around the East
End. Arts building.
Do they still have the theater in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Little old building on...
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, see, that was the old gym. And he said he remembered when they brought in the first woman member of the athletic department. And the first thing she wanted was stalls in the showers. And he said he just couldn't understand why anybody wants stalls in the shower.
Yeah. I was over there once. I took my family and I said, yeah, this used to be the gym. We're watching the children's play.
Yeah, he said that...
And they're laughing at me.
He said about once a year, the Department of Labor, Safety and Labor from the state would come in and say that balcony was not safe. And he said, well, tear it down, build me a new gym. He said, where are the kids are going to sit and watch the game?
Right.
And then they'd leave him go.
Yeah.
And the football field used to be right in back of that building. See? And he'd have to recruit people from town to make up his football team because he didn't have enough students.
Was that accepted amongst the normal
school? Oh, that time. Oh, that time it didn't matter.
Didn't matter.
See, you're talking back in the early 1900s, 1920s.
Yeah.
Because that time they played sports for fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you came at a real interesting time in the history of colleges in general, the late 60s.
I think you better believe it.
There was, there was a great social movement among the youth.
Very much.
On campuses and so on. Well, what was Edinburgh doing? The students went to Edinburgh.
All pretty typical. To me, when everybody keeps saying, oh, youth are youth, student are student, no matter what generation, I don't agree with them. There are certain general characteristics, there's no question of that, that covers all youth. You know?
Yeah.
When they come in as freshmen, they're either one of two kinds. They're either scared to death, and will hardly look at the faculty, really steady. Or they come in because they've heard that this is the play school. They're going to get rid of dad and mom. You had those two types, see. And of course, there's a sophomore. You know everything's a sophomore. Remember that? Including a couple of years ago. And junior, but by the time you're a senior, of course, you're, the boys are in the gray flannel suits. So you see, That is typical. But now the kids of the 60s, no, they were a different caliber. I'd say maybe, guess how much tape you had.
3 hours.
The other day, last couple of weeks, I don't know why, I've been going up to some of these young kids that I see wearing their caps backwards. See? In fact, the other day, yesterday, I was at a meeting, and I saw a boy with this cap. I said, tell me, why? Why are you wearing that cap backwards? He looked at me, kind of funny, you know, and he said, well, he said, just a fad. Now, there's your difference. Your kids of the 60s, particularly your late 60s, nothing was a fad. They were protesting or relating. And all that used to disgust me. Protesting or relating. See, everything had to have a reason. They wore not just comfortable or sloppy clothes. They were dirty. See, some of them almost smelled. And you would say to them, why? Well, I'm relating with the poor. And see, what they didn't realize, a lot of us on the faculty are depression kids. I remember particularly Bill Alexander, you know Bill, don't you?
He does the music. Instruments.
Yeah. Particularly Bill. Bill told them off on me. I told them off a couple times in class, too. Now, we were depression kids. And most of the time, we had maybe two pair of overhauls, maybe one, to wear to school. Now, we never felt ourselves poor, but as I look back, I realized they were. But we didn't want to look poor. So you try to keep those clean. You try to keep your hair cut, you see. So we yelled at him. We said, you're not relating to the poor. You're condescending to the poor. Well, they just wouldn't accept that. So you see, it wasn't just, now today, I still don't care for men with long hair, but I mean, actually. But today you'll find most fellows that wear long hair is neat. Well cut, well trimmed. See there, it was just dirty. So they were sloppy, they were dirty, they were protesting. Now they had a reason, Vietnam. And, but after Vietnam, about 73, 74, you begin to see this change gradually, where kids still would wear older clothes but more faddish. See, it was faddish. No, you don't have holes in your jeans. It was faddish to wear holes in jeans. Well, so what? No one cared about that, see. But what disgusted a lot of us in the faculty was this idea that they thought they were relating or trying to find myself. See? This is the type of thing that they were there. But they were, you want me to go on with this?
Yes.
Oh, okay. they really were what we call war babies. See, they were, most of them were born around World War II, after the war. My own son was. And during the war, it was ultra-patriotism. Right after the war, it was ultra-patriotism. So unfortunately, particularly in the public schools, but also a lot of your colleges, the United States never did anything wrong. They never did. If we invaded and interfered into the politics of Latin America, we weren't wrong. They were wrong. They couldn't think of the United States ever. Mexican War, it had to be an excuse. No, I didn't teach like that, I'm afraid. I said it was war. That was wrong. But this is what these kids grew up on. See, because you had the ultra-patriotism of World War II. So even your teachers were afraid, well, maybe I shouldn't say afraid, but didn't teach anything about the government. Now this perfect government, all of a sudden, went into Vietnam. And these kids, because this was the first war that was ever televised. Now, the only problem with the television was they weren't televising the enemy, so our boys got all the brunt for blame. See, my war. We had, my way to use a word. Oh, we had bastards in my war.
Yeah.
We had one sergeant, see, I was in an armored outfit, and we were way ahead of the infantry. And so we'd always have to go back through the enemy lines to take things. So he was supposed to take some prisoners back. And about a half an hour, he came back and said he tried to run away. Well, after he did that the second time, they court-martialed him for murder because he was just killing him. So you had it in my war.
Yeah. See?
But no one televised it. But here you were only televising the American participation. So that's the reason why the boys got such a dirty deal out of that. But now you see, your college-age kid saw that their government was wrong. We had no business in Vietnam. Then you also began to have your big civil rights marches. See? And they began to see that our society was racist. The government was not protecting the blacks. They began to see that this society wasn't perfect. And here they've been taught through school it was perfect. Then Watergate. You see, now you put all that together. And the kids just couldn't handle it. They couldn't separate the idea that even good people make mistakes. Okay? They couldn't see that our society, generally speaking, the best society in the world, had made some dastardly mistakes. Some of them unintentionally, some of them intentionally. They couldn't handle it. See? So they just threw it all out. See? Society's wrong. Government's wrong. Don't trust anybody over 35. I used to call them the cyanide age. I said, you kids must have a cyanide pill in your pocket. When you become 35, you're going to take it. But that was the reason. See? Yeah. They just couldn't handle this idea, if you will, the truth, that our government, our society, can make mistakes. The good people can go bad once in a while. And that doesn't make them all bad. So you see, they just want to throw everything out. Throw the society out. Anybody over 35 you don't trust. Government's no good. You don't trust anybody. And so then they began to think that they were relating to the poor, relating to the this or that. They just didn't know how to handle it.
So they dressed differently. They smelled.
Remember, I'm talking very broad generalization. It wasn't every kid. No.
Sure.
It was a group. Most of your students were involved in this idea of protest and finding this. Most of them are involved in that. But some of them, not all of them.
Oh, I didn't mean to.
No, some of them were addressing because you see, before that, you practically had a dress code. See, it's that during that period also that all these rights came in. See, you had a lot of spin-offs from civil rights. So you look in the catalog, you look in the handbook, and you'll see that all these things that were restricted of students are now going down the drain. They had their right. The house father couldn't come into the room unless they were invited in, or unless they even had warrants.
Right. You mentioned in your book about the ability to search and the way they had to word the policies.
Yes, what I see when I came, in fact, Dr. Hendricks, Luther Hendricks, was very much of a stickler. But if a student missed more than three classes without an excuse, you were to lower his grade. And I said right to him, I said, I'll be damned if I will. I said, there's no connection between attendance of class and the grade you make. I said, if a student can get a good grade in my class without coming to class, then I don't belong here. So I wouldn't do it. Well, he told me that was the rules and I would do it. Well, I didn't.
I had a really quick question involving grades. Because of the draft they were having going on, it seemed like every guy that was not in college was going for the draft. What was the academic atmosphere like on this campus? Because I had talked to people who, had gone to school at that time and said they kept pushing, don't flunk out of college, don't flunk out of college. And people that were right on the borderline, always pushing their professors to, give me a break, I'm going to be in Nam.
Oh yes, you did. I didn't have it very often because most of the fellows knew that I was a veteran, and most of them wouldn't say it to me. But they would try to beg, give me a break. I don't want to go to Vietnam because it's not a proper war, things like this.
Did they work any harder? Did it seem?
I didn't notice any. No. I suppose maybe some of them did, but no. If you're saying did it improve their academic ability or determination, no. I don't really think it did. As I say, I never had them come to me. All but one of the Vietnam boys came back. Of course, I told you last time, that's when I got in trouble all the time, because I stood up for the soldiers and still was against the war. And they just couldn't understand that. Oh, when the GIs came back, of course, they weren't treated as badly as the minority, but they still were treated something like minority. Of course, they were, after all, were GIs, and they were pretty tough boys, and most people didn't pull around with them.
There was a big change in women's rights on campus. As far as curfew.
All of that was involved. You had a big feminist movement that pretty much followed what you might say is the general national pattern. You had one group that went overboard. The women are completely insane, all of that, then you had another group that were sensible for women's rights. And that really, on this campus, I believe that latter group won out. The people who believed in women's rights, see, but not a lot of the silly stuff. But some of them were. You had the radical. Of course, there's always been a couple. Now, as a history student here, you should know this. One thing I always said in class is, of course, the British did it, and they're still doing it today in Ireland. You will not listen to the moderates. You will not even consider that they had any justification for what they were saying. And you're going to turn them into radicals. You know the story of Ben Franklin in the brown suit. See? The British have always done it. Now, McNerney did not do that. So I want to stress, he didn't. When you had these radical feminists, he'd talk to them. He just didn't shout at them. That's what they wanted. They wanted confrontation. They wanted to fight, all of them. I don't care who what group you're talking about. They wanted to fight. McNerney didn't. He would talk to them. And most of the faculties, he would listen. And a lot of times, the faculty would be supportive of the students in a lot of their protest things. And then the students would turn against the faculty, turning against the very same people that were supporting them. Now, but what I mean nationally. Mm-hmm. See, you had a lot of big protest and even burning of buildings on campuses. And here they were attacking the very people that usually were supporting. But remember what I said about these kids. They were just frustrated. They didn't know which way to go. They wanted the society to change. But they didn't know how to go about it. And you had to just gradually. After Watergate was over, after Vietnam was over, and I think your style of teaching all over started changing. People began to recognize that we could make mistakes. Then your kids can handle it.
It seemed like the faculty also gave a vent to some of these people with the teach-ins.
Oh, yes, sure. I was in teach-ins against Vietnam, sure.
They were all more liberal and were they critical? Were they conservative?
What do you mean?
Well, as far as
the
taking a point of view.
Well, in the teach-ins, most of your faculty, most of your faculty would be trying to use facts, and some of these other ideas that I told you about. I think really the teach-ins probably calmed the kids down more. They might have just been so frustrated that they'd gone out in violence. Not on this campus, because I didn't see it that bad. But it's a possibility. But you see, when you had the faculty coming in teach-ins and actually talking openly about it, it helped the kids kind of understand. But you can imagine, or maybe you can't, unless you live through it, how so much ultra-patriotism, see. Now, patriotism is excellent. I believe 1,000% patriotism. But this was ultra, this silly patriotism, see. We never did anything wrong. See? It was those Indians. It was the blacks. It was the Latin Americans. We never did anything. See, that's what they were taught. And it just couldn't handle it.
It was as if we knew what was best for those countries.
Oh, yes. Your people were convinced that, first, I think we got this from the English, that, one of the British problems is they don't think they can ever do anything wrong. They're always right. They still do today. We were that way. We're still a little bit alike. But the United States, we have the answer to everything. And that's what these kids are doing. You want us to dress like you dress, you faculty? Oh, no. You're the enemy. You're the society. We're going to dress this way. So it was a protest. Yeah.
And the blacks, you have a real good story about the black protest here on campus, about the sit-in.
The sit-in.
Yes.
Handled very well. As I say, I would give the main credit for handling that. To Dr. McDermott again, to John Robinson, the president of ABC, come by.
Attention library patrons. Will Harry Leibengood please come to the circulation desk on the first floor immediately?
Now that'll be something.
Harry Leibengood to the circulation desk on the first floor. Thank you.
We got that.
That'll be good to have on tape. Yeah, I would say McNerney and John Robinson, as I say, were the ABC, American Black Collegiate president on campus, and Irv R. Murphy. I think you give those three the credit for really calming that thing down. It all started at a fraternity, I don't know if it was a fraternity dance or whether it was in a student union, I forget that now. But a fraternity kid got in a fight with a black kid. And the fraternity brothers jumped on the black kid and back and forth. We had a big fight. About that time, why ABC, the American Black Collegians, with John Robinson, met off campus. And a lot of the black kids at that time were ready for violence. John was raised in a pretty rough area. I think he'd been in service. I can't remember whether John had been in service or not. But he was a level-headed kid. He wasn't afraid of violence. But he said that that's silly. We just don't need it. They met off campus. And some of the, I don't know if they were Black Panthers or not, but a black group from Erie called and said, we'll come down, Carlos, we'll help you out, just stay away. People that, in fact, the black kids would tell you that they were very conscious if you were condescending in your treatment. They just wanted you to go eye to eye. So we were talking about that in class one day, and I mentioned the idea that a lot of these radical groups were using the blacks rather than trying to be with them. Now, one of my kids in class, black girl, was going out to Boston to a big meeting of some black group, and I said, I want you to just look. And she said, what do you want me to look for? I said, you just look and come back and tell me. And when she came back, then I asked her, I said, did you have any white radical groups out there that you felt were trying to exploit you? Oh, she said, yes. She said it was disgusting. Just disgusting. So you had a group of white kids, the one to go with the black kids, ready to fight. John says, no. See? So they took their demands into McNerney. And McNerney had to say, I cannot accept unconditional demand. He had to say that, see? He said, I'll sit down and talk with you. John says, no, these are our demands. When they remember, that was what was going on all over the nation, see, unconditional demand. So they were in his office, so he just walked out. So they stayed there. Now, while they were there, this fraternity burned a cross. Over here, you know, when they moved from Normal Hall, I don't even know what the building is now, but it was built as a maintenance building, mm-hmm. And then they used it for the
early.
All right, early. Yeah, that's right. And they burned a cross outside, the three rocks on the windows and things like this. So finally, they called in the state police and the sheriff. And at first, some of the deputy sheriffs wanted to just ride in. The rest of the kids. Again, McNerney said, no. No. He said, we'll talk to them. But late that night, the state police finally said to the kids, well, you'll have to come out and listen to the rest. So John came out, John Robinson came out and talked to Dr. McNerney. And they made an agreement. And the sheriff didn't, and he said, now you're going to escort these kids home, the black kids. And people didn't want to. And McNerney said, you will. You escort them home. So now the next two or three days, you had a meeting. Now, since I was faculty representative at that time, I was at the meeting. So it was Dr. McNerney, John Robinson, he had a couple other kids with me. Oles Murphy, I think Al Huntley was there, I'm not sure, and myself. And we met, and McNerney and Murphy and Robinson would talk about these demands. And it came, I think, to a very reasonable agreement. Because if all sides will sit down and talk openly and reasonably, you can come to agreement. And they did. But none of the three actually were after each other. And I will say that Nick Nerney was great, but this John Robinson was just, he was something. He'd been in gang fights. He'd been in the city. I think he'd been in front of that. But anyway, very strong guy. Oh, he was a great fella. Very sensible. He really told me. Did I give enough about this?
That's good. That's good. I don't want you to leave without going over what you want to cover.
Okay.
I mean, I'm going to have to answer to a student?
The darndest things happen here.
I have a question about, they had an underground newspaper in 66.
Oh, almost every school had one.
Yeah, what did you know about that? It was called Prometheus?
Oh, I knew who was writing it.
What was the content on it?
Oh, again, now there would be one thing, remember I was talking about, there are certain things that students were students, all right, there is the same one.
Mm-hmm.
Any school will have an underground newspaper. And they were printing things that the Spectator would not accept. Harsh criticism against somebody. Satire. Most of it was satire.
Mm-hmm.
The satire. And of course anti-Vietnam and things like this. Yeah. Oh, one thing, now they didn't use in that newspaper. Another thing about the kids at that time, they tried to use vulgar language in class. Now this was just to show that they could do it. They try to smoke in class. Now at that time I was a pipe smoker. And if they do it in my class, if they start in life, I put it down. Put it out right now. Why? I can do what I want to. That's the attitude the kids have. Now you didn't see, well, that was somewhat the underground, but not that same thing. So I pull out my pipe and I says, here, I'm a smoker. But I said, there are two rights involved. Your right to smoke and the right on each person on each side. Not to have you smoke. Now, I said, in this class, their rights are superior, because in this class, I am the boss. And I never had any real trouble with that. Then he would start in using vulgar language or cussing. Now, the way I usually handled it, everybody handled it differently, I'd start laughing at them. Of course, that made him mad as the devil. And why are you laughing? I said, well, you should have your diapers changed and riding on your tricycle. I said, I lettered in three sports. I was in combat. I said, I don't think you can use any language that I have not heard, and unfortunately probably you sometime myself. I said, now, this just shows your ignorance, using this that offends other people. But permission didn't do that. It was a type of protest paper. It was just really, well, I remember I said, South Norwich. All right. Usually you find the South Norwich was writing it, not only, but it. No, you had those on all campuses, most generations, where they, the rules say we can't write this in Spectator, but we're going to write it. No what?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Nothing dangerous.
Right.
No.
I didn't figure it was probably, but I noticed it just from 66 to 69.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was
yeah.
Kind of trendy.
It was. That, you're right. It was trendy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That kid that probably was the editor probably wearing a gray flannel suit.
Can I just follow that question up? Well, that was a good question. The Spectator, is a student newspaper. It has gone through some changes. And some of the criticisms you might hear today is that it perhaps isn't so much a student newspaper as it is a university paper.
That's always been.
It's always been like
yes.
That?
Yes. At every school. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to know, I mean, was this a reaction to the unwillingness of the Spectator to be critical of the administration?
Yeah. No, again, you have a problem there. You've always had that problem. How far can the administration allow the newspaper to go? The administration, no matter what the students think, the administration is still legally responsible. If they allow them to go too far, you could have trouble with parents, you could have trouble with public. It was often difficult to keep a balance. So I've never been to a school where your students did not say, this is not our newspaper, it's administration newspaper. And there's some truth about it. Mm-hmm. Sure there is, because they would restrict them. They didn't want to be things, certain things mentioned in the newspaper that students wanted to mention, see? They didn't want to look bad for them. And you'll always have that. So you see, you'd have that in the Prometheus. If they didn't like something administration was doing or faculty, they'd have that in the Prometheus because the Spectator might not print it. I don't think this was peculiar to Edinburgh Library. It's like college food. Have you ever heard a student say the food's good? Of course, I'll have to admit myself, I'm not a connoisseur. College food and army food didn't bother me. Of course, half the time I forget to eat, so I'm no judge. But the same type of thing.
I have one other question also about, well, the ROTC program had its base down in Edinburgh. I think it worked through Allegheny
or Gannon, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the student attitude, or just the basic attitude?
Well, because you see, that's right around Vietnam.
Right.
And they didn't want it. Mm-hmm. Because they said, well, we're a racist nation, we're a war nation, and we don't want to support this. And I would keep saying to the kids myself, I'd say, look, when I was in service, some of the most sensible officers we had came out of ROTC because they were college men. And they were usually more sensible. I said, now, if you're going to have an army, why not bring it from a college? But this was their attitude. They were just protesting anything that was against the war. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the kids went to either Gannon or we got a cooperative program with the ROTC in those two places. But you usually would have some officers on campus, too. But what was disappointing later on, I know I had an advisor that really wanted to go into the service. And there were so many officers when he graduated, he couldn't get a regular assignment. He was disappointed.
There's only one other thing I had covered. I was reading through your book, and you mentioned something about in 68 there was
I'm glad you read the book.
part of the job.
Some type of hippie community, actually, in Crawford County.
Oh.
I think it was based on student activity all of it.
Yeah, again, in that time you had a lot of those things where they, sort of a cult.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily dangerous, but it was a cult where they lived together.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see you had another group, I forget what they called themselves, they were a bunch of church people, Christians.
Church,
something like that. Yeah. And see, people get them confused with your cult, mm-hmm. It could be cult. But again, you see, that was a big trend. They kept calling communal societies. Well, one of my specialties was studying communal societies. And I said, they're not a communal society. They said, well, there's a big difference. See, communal society didn't wasn't one that was active, that was protesting. They just lived together communally and left everybody else alone. And you see, people like this were always trying to tell you that you were wrong. Something like some of your feminists and some of your gay people today are doing, see. Rather than just saying, I want my rights and I live like I want to, which I agree with, they say, you should be like me too, or you're wrong. See? They're trying to say, you are condemning me and saying I'm immoral, when actually they're condemning us. See? I don't like that kind of stuff. I mean, I'll respect their rights, but don't tell me that I'm wrong. And that's what these people, they were a cult. Yeah. Well, that's where the term hippie came in at that time. I mean, that's the years that the term hippie came in. I don't know what it means.
I think it actually stood for something, didn't it? Hippie?
Yeah.
I think it did.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but.
I don't know.
Then there were yippies for a while.
Yippies, yeah. No, yippie and the hippie. And the hippie.
Then there were yuppies in the 80s.
Yeah, that was the age of names and nicknames and initials and letters.
Yeah. You were, you were here during the time of the Noble Hall fire. Did you actually witness the fire?
Well, I didn't say it started, of course. This is what I was at home. I happened to be at home. Heard the fire whistle go off. I happened to look out the front door, and I saw the flames shooting up in the air and the smoke. So I ran down, so I suppose half an hour after this. And the kids. Now, you see, there was an interesting thing. This, at that time, kids were burning down buildings all over the nation, and well, I shouldn't say that. like, they were burning down some buildings and some campuses throughout the nation, see, and getting all the press. So here our kids were running in and out of Normal Hall, grabbing everything they could. And there was one faculty, by the way, I don't know where he found them, found a whole stack of Playboy magazines and ran out with it. I was but, they were running out. In fact, they were continually doing it until the firemen just had to practically push them out, said that the ceiling is going to fall, you just won't dare come back in and get it. I would say, I don't suppose they saved 100% of all the papers and important things, but boy, I'm telling you, they saved it, see. So, what did they do over the national news when they told about the fire and the kids doing it? They put them together as if these were the same kids that were, it sounded like it, see, and I don't think they did it intentionally. But it made us mad around here because we said, hey, here on this minute you're talking about the kids that are burning down the campus, and here you're talking about the kids at our place, and you don't make a big difference. You just almost sound like they're the same people. But oh no, the students and the faculty and everybody else was running in and out of that building, taking things out. Now here's another interesting thing. See, in my home state, Indiana, at that time at least, if you had a state institution, no matter what it was, but let's say a particular college, if you had a state institution in a small town, the state government appropriated money equal to the taxes that town lost because of that institution. Am I clear what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You see, Pennsylvania does not. See, they don't do the school anything. So the local fire department, about 2 or 3 years before the fire, had come to administration and said, ask the state to donate some money so we have a chance to buy a ladder fire truck, inexpensive ladder fire truck, but we don't have the money. Can't the state donate some? And McNerney called down to the state, no, they wouldn't do it. Now, could they have saved it? I don't know. You know, with the ladder truck, I don't know. Yeah. Because the fire probably had been burning for hours before they actually caught it. Because, you see, they put in false ceilings. Yeah. And they're pretty sure that it started within that false ceiling on the third floor. So how long? It might have been going too much. So you can't say that the ladder truck would have saved the building. But that's just an example, you see, that the state would not appropriate any money. And heaven's sakes, I don't know if I have the percentage in the book or not, but I think it's well over 50% of your calls to a volunteer fire company come on the campus. Particularly ambulance calls. And we used to gripe at the kids in class, at his new faculty, about them setting off false alarms. Because see, they thought it was funny. Well, again, that's typical nowadays quite often. But I said, not funny. I said, you're taking those fellows away from work, or away from a warm bed, and cost them, I think at that time, $75 every time they took the truck out of the barn. And jeopardize lives. They couldn't understand it, but most of your calls came right in. And the college did. They gave a big banquet for the firemen and all the people in the house. I think the college showed, and the students showed, proper appreciation for the fire company.
It was right about this time, I think in 1970, that student government formed?
Yeah, SGA.
Mm-hmm. What did they do before that?
You had a student faculty government.
Okay.
And of course in a student faculty government it depends upon the faculty that are involved. I didn't dismiss you.
It's the 90s, these students, they just leave.
It depended upon the faculty.
Yeah.
How much input the students would have. And I suppose if you look at it carefully you find that further back you go, the more the faculty just practically told the students what to do, you see. That it was student input without any. But again, this is the time when you were gradually giving the students more control. So you had a student faculty government, then you had finally the student government. And from that it just snowballed.
And it's fairly independent. Well, today they can buy a building, they have so much money.
Well, yeah. Well, you see, you had the foundation that was separate from the administration that bought all those buildings back over in there. I keep forgetting that's not a video. What is the street?
Meadville Street?
Huh? No, not Meadville, off of
Darrell?
Darrell Road, yeah. All those apartments, you see, you had that separate foundation that bought those, owned them for many years.
The same
group, yeah, the same group that finally bought the House of the Seven Gables.
Is that still there?
I don't even know. Now, wait a minute. I think a faculty member bought the house at 17. I can't even think. Somebody. Seems like some faculty member bought that in the last few years. Because they were asking me how to go up and check deeds, you know, take the deeds back and see when it was originally built. Because
yeah.
Cooper originally owned all of that.
Uh-huh.
The original principal.
Right.
But you see, your student government bought that, and the students felt that they paid too much for it, and quite a controversy.
I want to kind of shift then into some of the faculty concerns. And what we still have today is a union, the APSCA union. Can you talk a little bit about the foundation of APSCA?
Formation. Well, before that, you had the, I forget the exact title of it. You had the Association of Pennsylvania State Teachers College. You had I think that started back in 1937.
Okay, that was just an association, that wasn't...
An association, all right. Now, you see, when I came, you didn't call it state teachers, because after all, we were not a state teachers college then, we were a state college, not a university yet. So you still had the Association of Pennsylvania State College faculty. Now that's an association. And we used to go down, because I was a delegate to it, we'd go down to Harrisburg and you'd practically hitchhike.
Yeah.
And you'd start from here and we'd pick up people at Clarion or Slippery Rock and see, because the organization didn't have any money. But I'm telling you, they did a lot just with that association. They were able to get in sick leave. They were able to get in, I forget what it was about Social Security, something Social. They were able to get in agreement on hours of teaching, many different things that that association did without being a union. Now, what they really was more difficult, because they would have to do it just by convincing the politicians that this is what they needed. And they did a whale of a good job. Well, after Indiana became a university, now I'm talking about Pennsylvania.
Okay.
After Indiana became a university, then they called that the Association of State College and University Faculty, ABSCA. And we still, no union. Well, after Act 195 was passed, I think it was 1970, then the big question was, should we, the faculty, form a union where we have a contract? Well, I always supported unions, always did. In fact, when I went to college, I worked my way through college, we would always be a membership of a union. See, we were just gung-ho. Well, you can imagine a college kid. We were gung-ho radical union
yes.
people, see. But still, I was one of those who did not see the advisability of forming a union. I couldn't see it, see. So we would talk about it at ABSCUF meetings. We usually have on campuses. Should we become a union? Well, finally it came down to the fact that the state was going to have an election on who was going to represent the faculty. ABSCA finally decided to become a union. So it's the same association that now becomes a union. Then you had the question, who would represent the faculty? And you had the AAUP, American Association of University Professors, at the NEA, and you had AFT, AFL, that wanted to be the representative.
Yep.
So we had a big meeting to get where it was. I want to say Bloomsburg, but I'm not sure. And we brought in representatives of the AAUP and the AFT and the NEA, because we were talking about affiliation. Well, now the AFT said, we can't affiliate. We have to be it.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't nasty about it. They just said, that's our policy. Yeah. The AAUP were not very much interested in a merger with ABSCA. But the NEA was, the Teacher Association. PSEA, I'm saying the NEA. PSEA, Pennsylvania State. Okay. So we did. We went together. We didn't actually merge, but we had a coming to the mind, meeting the minds of ABSCOF and PSEA. Is that right? Pennsylvania
State
Education Association, PSEA. Okay. Al Huntley was primarily here on the campus, was the main one on that. So really, ABSCOF and PSEA was really the what I'm saying. You had to vote on the bargaining unit, and we won handily. ABSCOF won handily.
Yeah.
I see most of us were members of both. I wasn't PSEA because I'd never taught public schools in Pennsylvania, but a lot of them were. Most of your people, Department of Education, were PSEA. But I was at EUP. I was at EUP for many years. Now, Lou Meyer was the, on this campus, Lou Meyer was the head of EUP. By the way, there's another one you should review. He was at EUP. Al Huntley was PSEA. I don't really remember if we had anybody at EUP here on this campus. But ABSCOF won handily statewide, so we became the bargaining unit. I say I was state secretary of ABSCOF for about 10 years. This seems like I spent 5 weekends out of every 4 to Harrisburg. Yeah. And you want me to go with this?
Yes, please.
Okay. ABSCOF hired Marty Moran, who had had a pretty good reputation as far as labor negotiator. So Marty was our labor negotiator. So we got a, it was interesting, our first meeting that we had, first contract negotiation. Because we people are officers of State ABSCOF. We would meet a couple nights before. We'd go down to Harrisburg and meet a couple nights before with our bargaining team. We had a bargaining team. The officer couldn't be on the team. We'd have we had a meeting. And after all, being college professors, we would be the devil's advocate, that is, the officers.
Yeah.
And we would just throw everything we could think of at those people. And if we'd say something to him, well, what about this? Now you want this. What are your statistics? And these fellows are looking. I'm talking about in the hotel, or wherever we were. Don't know. So, things would stop. I don't care what time of night it was.
Yeah.
Things would stop. They'd go to the phone. Now here's the thing that the state didn't realize. The state hired this, I can't think of his name. The state hired a lawyer that had never lost a negotiation, and every negotiation he'd been through, there'd always been a strike. He had a reputation. He's from Philadelphia. We didn't care for him. Now, what they didn't realize was, when we would practice, what would these people do? They knew somebody on one of the 14 campuses who was expert in that field.
Oh.
See? Yeah. So by the time we got to that table, my gosh, we had everything. We had all the, let's think, you had 14 campuses to draw from on expertise in any kind of a subject you wanted. And these people would have the statistics in there. And of course, we didn't have the facts and all that stuff, you know. You had to fly it down, and we didn't fly it down, drive it down, or give it to you over the phone. But you had everything. And all I, because we would attend quite often, we would attend the negotiating meetings. And Marty would be negotiating. I wish I could think of that lawyer's name. Marty would be talking to him across the table. Something come up, and Marty would just turn to one of the negotiating team or one of the officers, because we could speak up, and ask for some statistics or background or documentation. Of course, we knew who had it. See? And throw it at him. And I'm telling you, it was just funny. You know how the, you know, negotiations, somebody would say, well, we'd like to have a recess. Those state people were just calling for recesses all the time. We were just snowing them. And to make a long story short, we got our contract. The first time this guy had ever been, you might, I don't want to say defeated, but anyway, any time, he had a reputation that the opposition never won anything from him. So we got everything from him.
Yeah.
Our first contract was considered one of the best in the nation. And that was to the credit of Marty Moran and the negotiating team, of course, but also because most of the people that represent the state were hired lawyers.
Yeah.
Well, you see, a hired lawyer, just like this O.J. case, they're not there trying to get the truth. They're just wanting to get the reputation, the money, and win. It's like a professional ball team. They don't care about playing the game. They just care about winning. This is what makes me disgusted with this stuff. That's another subject. But now that's just about the attitude these guys had. See, they were used to that game. We were used to documentation. And you had a whole faculty of 14 schools to help you out.
Yeah.
So we came out with a terrific contract. I forget what our... Now, a lot of the things in... Of course, we were interested in money. Because we were way underpaid. But one of the main things we were interested in was more control over academics. So see, at that time, we got more control over the election of the department chairman and also hiring of new faculty. Because quite often, the administration, the politician particularly, would talk about, say to us, well, you've got such lousy faculty. And we say, so who hired him?
Yeah.
We had nothing to do with it. You wouldn't even allow us to speak up. So in the first contract, we had it in there that the faculty could elect the chairman, and that we had something to do with the hiring of a person coming in from outside. So they said, now after this, if we hire somebody that doesn't work out, then that's our problem. But don't blame us for what you did in the past. That didn't work out 100%. But it worked out pretty well.
So the support for the union among the faculty here on campus?
At first, not strong at all. Then it began, as we began to get some of our problem, particularly the so-called retrenchment, which is a euphemism for firing. When that came about, and they saw some other things that we could do, and again, they say, even though I was the president of ABSCUP here on the campus when the meeting came in. And I respected and fought for unions, I still didn't like the idea of us being a union.
Yeah.
See what I mean? It's sort of an attitude. And but when I saw then finally what we could do for academics and for the faculty because we were a union that we couldn't do before. And most people on the campus then eventually accepted the idea of a union, yes. And we had good solidarity on the campus. Oh, there were a few that were not paying attention to at all. But generally speaking, yes, you did. It took a few years to get it through. Because we were snobbish professionals.
Of course. I think we...